Hey, everybody. Hi, David. Folks, if you'd please take your seats. We've got time clocks up here for this event this morning, so it's very important to get through my part, pretty important to get through John Hanek's part and get to some other things here. So if everybody could please be seated. Good morning. I'm David Johnson, the president and CEO of BioCrossroads and the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. I want to thank our sponsors today, the Purdue Foundry, Heiss Miller, Guttwein Law Firm, and Miles Printing, for this remarkable Frameworks event. This is going to be fun and a little different from something we've done for a long time. When Raul Zavaleta, actually, and I were talking about something that ended up becoming BioCrossroads about 15 years ago this summer, one of the things that we were talking about was that we had a great institutional life sciences culture, and Raul had been involved with a couple of startups coming out of that culture and background that had been very successful here. But with a few exceptions, we were still really needing the universities that were here to begin to play a more dominant part in the landscape. Purdue'd sort of gotten a head start. Indiana University, this is 2001, 2002, 2003. Indiana University was just at that point really getting into the technology transfer and licensing business, but hadn't yet put the Emerging Technology Center at the head of the canal, didn't really have a home place for innovation. And Notre Dame was still really contemplating what the role of technology transfer was in an institution that had historically been more focused on the humanities and undergraduate education than on research and tech transfer. So in 15 years, and actually even in a decade or a whole lot less, we have come a remarkably long way with all three of our university collaborators here. And we are really blessed as a state, a relatively small and compact state of fewer than 7 million people, to have three great research universities that are also each in their own separate ways focused on doing something in the landscape of innovation here by sending promising companies, promising innovation, and promising talent out to make things happen. So the purpose of this morning, and this may feel a little bit to some of the participants like discussions they have with potential investors, but this is not an investment meeting. This is a meeting for all of you to hear about what it takes to get some of these companies started, some of them going, what they're trying to do, and the exciting opportunities that they see in bringing remarkable discoveries to help patients, to improve lives, and to better our economy in the process. One thing about life sciences companies that all of us have been involved with them for now so long really, really, really understand, and I especially see it when I look with envy at my colleagues at TechPoint, people that seem to be able to start a company in about 10 minutes and have revenues about 20 minutes later. That's not this sector, folks. The upside is really high, but the time to that upside is usually also very long. And most people, I see a number of people here who have been in this journey with us for quite a long time. Most of us ended up signing up for something that's taken a little longer in some cases than we expected because we're dealing with frontier science. We're dealing with frontier regulatory issues and policies that keep changing, and we have a constant need for more talent and more people and, frankly, more money on the landscape to make those things happen. In that race and in that competition, we really are dependent upon our great research universities to throw out the kind of innovation that gives us, for example, this year in our new venture competition for BioCrossroads in October, 33 entrants, most of whom we had not heard of prior to that. And we see that every year, more and more new companies coming forward. But it's because of the research universities we have, and again, the wonderful and complementary efforts of Purdue, Indiana University, and Notre Dame in making that happen. So we're going to turn the program over this morning to the leader of one of those efforts, John Hanek, from the Purdue Foundry and the managing director for Purdue Ventures. John is really the dean of this landscape in many, many respects. He has worked, and Purdue is working with a number of the companies, only a couple of which you can see today, but a number of promising companies on the landscape. And there are wonderful things going on in West Lafayette that John is going to tell you about to put Purdue's efforts in context. Know that there's an IU story and a Notre Dame story to all of this as well, and we'll be telling those stories over time as well. But today, we're going to turn this over to John, have him lead the discussion, and then you're going to see some pretty fast-paced presentations and discussions. So, John?
I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Sorry. Out of my peripheral vision.
Thanks, David.
Thanks very much.
Yep, thank you.
Mind the clock.
Hello, everybody. Good morning, everybody. I had to get up really early for this, so come on. Actually, David's comments are very much appreciated and brings to mind a kind of a couple of interesting, anecdotes. One is in terms of speaking, how long it takes for an overnight success in the life sciences space. We just recently closed, many of you know, a Series A round with Animated Dynamics. And it was a $1.7 million round, really has become kind of a big move in success for them. And I just remember it at one session with somebody that had not really invested a lot in life sciences. I was with David Nolte and John Turek, the founders of the company, and somebody made a comment of, wow, this has happened so fast. You know, it's an overnight success. And David pointed out that he and John have been working on this for 15 years. So what we see is, you know, just the last year or two or maybe 3 years, they're kind of the quintessential foundry client, somebody that started with us early on, going back to the OTC and licensing the technology, going through ideation with us. I'm going to show a slide in a little bit that kind of goes through does this move the slides? Oh, okay. Kind of goes through our process, and I'll probably use them as an example a couple of times. Another interesting thing relative to the university-based research going on in the state, we do some things with Notre Dame. David Brenner, you know, started Innovation Park up there. He's now retiring. Teresa Sedlak, we're doing a lot of stuff with her, actually on the funding side, looking at angel networks and university-based investing. IU, long history, obviously. When we started the network of technology centers throughout the state, we were doing a lot of work with Mark Long when he was running the IU ETC at IU. And then later, Tony. In fact, I always remember when we had the grand opening of the tech center for the Indianapolis Research Park out by the airport, I remember Tony being there, really glad that he was sharing in the celebration with us. And then I caught him in the hall talking to somebody, explaining to them why they should move into the tech center, why they should move into the Purdue Tech Center. So, I mean, we all like to kid around and joke about the rivalry, and that's very real. You know, I can always remember talking to Morgan Burke, who's now our outgoing athletic director, about things we're doing with IU, but boy, he was always focused on the next game against them. So a lot of that's very real, but so is the collaboration. What I'd like to do, if you'd go to the next slide, is just kind of, I'm going to bring a little bit of a different angle to my comments than maybe we've typically done regarding the foundry. This is going to be more of an integrated look at what makes up all these moving parts at Purdue that's really enabled us to generate a high level of activity around the commercialization of technologies through startups. And it's not just the foundry, it's not just the research park, it's really all these moving parts that you can sort of see on this slide, which involves Discovery Park, it involves all the research and the 409 labs at Purdue, it involves the funding for the research and then crossing over that line into the commercialization. Next slide, please. And they're all kind of based on a certain set of principles. This is actually a slide from a course that I teach on university entrepreneurship centers. But as I was preparing for this, I thought this was kind of pertinent relative to these five or six points in terms of what drives us with what we're doing in terms of commercializing. So obviously best practices, we're very much a part of the International Business Innovation Association, the Association of University Research Parks, the Association of University Technology Managers. And we not only give back, but we also learn a great deal. It's really critical in this space to be on top of the best practices. Roles for faculty and students in spin-out companies, very critical to what we're doing. The 77 startups that we've created in the last 3 years, those are startups that are commercializing Purdue intellectual property. There's a very similar number that have other Purdue connections that we've started up that wouldn't be happening if we weren't actively looking at roles for faculty and students. Tech transfer licensing models that work for new ventures. That's a little bit out of my scope, but I'm going to share a slide or two later that shows some of the things that we're doing on the policy level that have made a huge difference. Building sustainable practice of entrepreneurship programs for students and faculties, that's what really goes way beyond just the foundry, where our focus is on commercializing activity. But the faculty is involved with what we call the DIF program. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Things that are going on with interdisciplinary research at Discovery Park. There's just a lot of moving parts with a whole lot of people involved that are bringing this all together. And then leveraging regional ecosystems and resources to support university startups. We have a director of collaborations, Riley Gibb. Our former director of collaborations, Mike Assem. Where's Mike? Mike is here down from Chicago, now works as a VC in Chicago. Their role, that role has specifically been all about connecting to the larger entrepreneurial ecosystem. This is an activity that requires tapping into talent in central Indiana, in the Chicago region, the Midwest, and ultimately globally. We do a lot of things coast to coast, not just with our network of VCs and investors, but also on the talent side. Next slide, please. So the Purdue Foundry, how many of you are pretty familiar with the Foundry? Okay, so I'm going to direct these comments to those of you that didn't raise your hand. It's just, to me, it's a great story, and it goes back to Mitch Daniels coming aboard as president. This effort is very, very much about leadership and vision. It became clear to Mitch as he was, you know, he had that six-month period from when the trustees named him as the incoming president till he finished his final term as governor. And during that period of time, he did a lot of kind of look and would get up to West Lafayette frequently to understand what the big issues were. One of them, the one that impacts us the most, was that he recognized that we weren't doing a great job of commercializing technologies that were springing out of the university's research dollars. We had an award-winning incubation program. We had award-winning research parks. But honestly, there was a gap there relative to helping those researchers that wanted to commercialize through a startup. So then entered Dan Hassler as president of the Research Foundation, and then kind of the movement towards trying to recognize what we needed to do structurally and in terms of support to move these technologies into the marketplace. And the highest calling in that, and this was really key, the highest calling in that really came, and you could probably go back and look at some speeches that Mitch delivered. The highest calling was really getting these technologies into the marketplace for the benefit of society. And that's a little bit different than a lot of times what you see going on at a university where people are trying to optimize licensing models or commercialize for the benefit of an equity stake. Ours was really that higher calling. So there were three of us that were involved with the research parks and the tech centers that were basically kind of pulled aside and told to figure something out that would be this entity that would represent, in my words, the easy button. There is no such thing. It is, we do a lot of life sciences stuff, right? But the easy button for those researchers that wanted to commercialize through a startup. Next slide, please. You can just flip through these. Next one. So we have a series of programs. Actually, if you'd go to the next slide, I want to be really mindful of time here. I really wanted to put this slide up because you have absolutely no chance of reading it. So I'll just read it for you. This kind of shows a sequence of what we do, even though so much of what we do is not sequential. I always say we take our clients where we find them, and in some cases they're pretty far advanced, and there's some things that we can help them with. In other cases, we really need to start them from the square one. And in the case of somebody that's just on the verge of doing a disclosure to the Office of Technology Commercialization, That's the best time for us to engage. So we work with them on ideation. That's the far left box. Then we move them through a process, potentially creating the company. We've done that multiple times. And then get them into this customer discovery and market discovery activity. Then from there, they start moving a little bit more, a little bit more externally. And we start to work with them under the Purdue Ventures umbrella, which is just an umbrella within the Foundry umbrella, and start working with them on funding, working with them on business planning, working with them on talent acquisition. And we just try to take them down this trail that ultimately is as supportive as can be until such time as they have the funding to kind of move forward on their own. Next slide. So the changes in policy, the changes in focus, the creation of the Foundry, which today exists and functions in a way that I think we probably couldn't have predicted 3 years ago. If you look back at our planning documents from 3.5 years ago, the reality today looks much different. We have 10 entrepreneurs and residents that are working with us on a one-on-one basis with every one of our companies. We have 4 funds that were that provide everything from proof of concept to seed funding. We've built networks of talent. None of you are getting out of this room unless we know who you are and where we can reach you, because we're going to need you at some point, because this is absolutely a huge undertaking. But you can see from this slide, these are the number of startups commercializing Purdue intellectual property year over year. And you can see that in the last 3 years, we've done 25, 26, and 27, or 24, 26, and 27. I can tell you this about Mitch Daniels. He's metrics-oriented and metrics-driven, and he can cite these numbers to you. So these are very, very important numbers to us. They are all still functioning, except one. These are companies that have been formed. They've been staffed. They have some type of funding to one extent or another. It may be non-dilutive, but they are actually in a functioning mode. And you can see how the last 3 years stacks up to prior years. So where does this put us on the larger map? The 2014 Association of University Technology Managers data, 2014 being the last they published, had, in terms of universities that had the highest number of companies that were created commercializing their IP, number one in the world is University of California System, so that's UC Irvine, UCSD. Nine research universities in one system. They're number one. University of Texas with 6 locations is number 2, and Purdue West Lafayette is number 3. But that's not the cool news. The cool news is Stanford is number 4 and MIT is number 5. That's what we really like. So, yeah, we're very proud of that, but this is where, I mean, the work really begins. I mean, this is not something that we can sit back and rest on our laurels, because what we need to do is increase the number of disclosures, increase the number of patent prosecutions, increase the number of issued patents, and keep driving that commercialization number higher all the time while our Office of Technology Commercialization is doing their work, not just with our startups, but also with licensing into the larger corporations. Next slide. And this is where I would love to spend time talking about OTC, but it does kind of get beyond my scope. I think suffice to say, there has been, over the years, a significant change in approach and philosophy as well as policy at the OTC. And it's all about, again, going to that higher vision of moving technologies into the marketplace for the purpose of, for the benefit of society. And that's not always been the case. But I think today we probably work more closely with our tech transfer group than ever before. We're all on the same page trying to move these things forward. And with that, I'm actually going to stop here because I have 33 seconds. What we're going to do now is have you hear from 6 or 7 companies from throughout the state. These are not just Purdue companies. And all they're each going to get 10 minutes. And how they use that 10 minutes is up to them. I suspect the way this will work is 6 or 7 or maybe 8 minutes for them to talk to you about their technology, leaving a couple of minutes for Q&A. I am going to be the time police, and I'm going to absolutely cut it off at 10 minutes because we've promised to get people out of here on time. So I'm not even going to go through a long introduction. I'm going to leave that up to each company. And I'd like to start with Kyle Hultgren from Imagine Medical Devices.
All right. Thank you very much, John. My name is Kyle Hultgren. I'm the founder and CEO of Imagine Medical Device. And I do want to just start by thanking John and the Purdue Foundry, Purdue Ventures, the Office of Technology Commercialization. These folks have really put together an amazing package to mold us into entrepreneurs. And sometimes it might feel more like molding a bucket of water than clay, but they've done a tremendous job. So I'll get started if my slides are up here. What is the problem we're working on? So my background, you'll see in a moment, I'm a pharmacist by training. I worked clinically in hospitals and health systems. And many times what I got involved in was medication safety. How many times people were being hurt unintentionally by medications designed to help them? Specifically, one of the more helpful but simultaneously harmful medications we have is insulin. Many of you may know someone with diabetes. Some of you may, statistically speaking, even have diabetes or prediabetes. There are almost 10 million people in the United States that are dependent upon insulin to treat diabetes. And so there's a lot of options for this. Some people, you may have seen the little insulin pumps or pens. But one of the gold standards to this day when the technology fails is using a vial and syringe. Many people with diabetes that use insulin maintain syringes and vials as either a primary plan or a backup plan. Unfortunately, insulin is something we call very narrow therapeutic. The idea is that if you're on a certain dose, if you take 10 units of insulin and you take just as much as 15, that can be enough to put you into a coma or cause very severe harm. Almost 100,000 people every year go to the emergency room from unintentional harm associated with insulin use. It can be very difficult to be able to manage this. Additionally, some of the challenges for folks with late-stage diabetes, some of the things that happen as complications of diabetes are two of the first things that kind of additionally fail. Your eyesight begins to go. You know, the sugar in your blood begins to build up, and sometimes your eyesight gets very blurry. And also in areas, so your toes and your fingertips, you start to lose sensation. So the option right now, if you've ever seen an insulin syringe, it's very, very tiny. And being able to both feel and see that to dose yourself can be a little complicated. So what we've come up with is this right here. You'll see on the left-hand side a standard insulin syringe. And what are technology? We've got a series of patents, patent-pending technologies that we've licensed from the Office of Technology Commercialization at Purdue. And this is what we call perimeter-fill syringe technology. A standard syringe, you may be familiar, is just a hollow plunger and a solid piston that pushes fluid out the top. What we've done is there's actually, on the drawing on the right-hand side, you can see there's a solid core. And so this enables fluid to fill just a thin perimeter or ring around that central shape. This enables us to dramatically increase the diameter and maintain the overall length of the syringe. What I kind of like to say, if you want a really good analogy, it really becomes the fat crayon of insulin syringes. So you can tell I've got young children, and as opposed to the normal-sized crayons, you get the large fat crayon, if you will. And so this is that proverbial fat crayon of insulin syringes. Easier to manipulate, easier to see, easier to use, makes the dosing window much easier to identify, and enables you to be able to more accurately manipulate and draw up insulin doses. So what does the market look like for this? This particular technology, I already talked about, there's roughly about 8 to 10 million people that utilize insulin. And specifically, one of the first places that we're looking at is a subset of right at 800,000 to a million people utilize something that is known as concentrated insulin. Most insulins, without getting too technical, comes in a concentration, right? And so in a certain volume, it's 100 units of insulin in 1 milliliter of fluid. As I told you, some doses are as small as 10 units. So we're talking very small increments. There's a certain subset of people with diabetes that need to use greater than 150 or 200 units per day. So you're looking at almost 2 milliliters. If you ever had a flu shot before, right, and that kind of hurts, it's a half a milliliter, give yourself 4 flu shots every single day. That's 2 milliliters of insulin. So that's why we've got something called concentrated insulin, or 500 units per milliliter. It's dosed twice a day. But at this stage, you find people oftentimes have, again, experienced many of those difficulties with tactile sensation and eyesight. So being able to offer them a much better solution is a good opportunity. And so that's kind of the overall scope of how many people are utilizing these products and what's the overall trend. The overall trend, unfortunately, right now is that diabetes continues to grow in the United States, and the requirement for insulin products continues to grow as well. Pumps and pens are growing in double digits, 10 to 12% per year. But simultaneously, we see that the old standby, and you'll see that there's no silicon, there's no lines of code, there's no microchips in these syringes. But even still, in this technology, you'll find that it still grows at almost 6 to 8% per year as well. Vials and syringes are a time-honored and tested method of delivering insulin that people with diabetes will continue to depend on when all else fails. So what are we looking at right now? What is our current status? We've moved from everything from concept. We've moved through the stages in the Purdue Foundry. We have gone through the commercialization process with the Office of Technology Commercialization and working on patent-pending technology now. And so we have moved through, and we have, again, with partners, again, Indiana-based manufacturers have been outstanding and very wonderful to Imagine Medical Device. We have moved through five rounds of prototyping, and we're ready now to move on to in beginning with some solid steel tools and injection molding. We need to be able to provide this final design concept for what's called a 510K process. This is what the FDA uses to evaluate medical devices. Not all medical devices, but this particular class. So you're not thinking people would talk about some of our neighbors here in Indianapolis spend, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to get a molecule approved. Well, some of these devices are much more inexpensive, but the process is rigorous because you're doing something called predicate. I can prove that an insulin syringe existed before this. I've modified the geometry, and we're not actually storing medication in here. So that process, that time frame gets dramatically shortened, but it's still a very rigorous process. So we're entering into that process right now in terms of writing that 510K and making sure the device is safe to enter the market space. So that's where we're at, and that is my six-minute speech. Normally, when I'm good for 100 words, I'll do. I'm good for 1,000. But John's had me practicing up one side and down the other. So I want to stop there and to give you a chance to ask questions or give the next company an opportunity to come up and use their time. Yes.
This is excellent.
Thank you very much.
Fill this with epinephrine and
let's so that I'll repeat the question then. So the question was, can you fill this with epinephrine and solve that problem as well? The short answer is, in theory, no, not out of the gate, because one of the reasons why we're able to go through the 510K process is that we don't store medications in here. But certainly could it be used to draw up other medications. We're going to explore additional uses, whether it be for veterinary or additional medications as well. So very good point. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your presentation. Do you know what the cost will be per syringe? Oftentimes, so I'm with Senator Donnelly's office. We often hear from veterans or folks that are on Medicare that they're no longer able to acquire X number of syringes and those sorts of things. And so
Correct. What
is the cost per unit of a traditional syringe compared to what you're developing? And tell us a little bit more about that factor.
Certainly. So the cost per unit, we're still working that out. So when we go through the injection molding phase and get the final production costs, that is going to be dependent largely on what kind of volume can we make. You know, we're making 10 million or 100 million or a billion. And so, but at the end of the day, largely that is based upon the fixed cost of, if I won't go back, but you remember it's permafield, so there's actually a little bit more plastic. Now, plastic is certainly has an associated cost with that. We still need to source what kind of plastic we're going to use. So because there actually is more material, you'll see an incrementally, not a significant, but you'll see a little bit of a jump in price. But largely that's going to be associated just with the cost of materials and not with the cost of holding people over the coals for something like epinephrine. So, but you're going to see an incremental increase simply based upon the fact there's a little bit more material. But we're not talking appreciable 25, 50% jump. It's going to be based upon that material cost. The question is, what other drugs have we looked at to incorporate in this technology? Right now, we have not formally investigated other medications yet for use. We're really focusing on that minimum viable product right now. And so we want to make sure that we're able to come into the space and really execute very well with insulin in the diabetes market. And so we're going to focus on that first. And actually, some of the things investigated certainly were epinephrine or many drugs that are going to be used in acute settings. So certainly insulin is used acutely when you're ingesting food. Epinephrine is used acutely when you have some form of allergic reaction as well. So we're looking at more of those acute use medications you can draw up.
I like your focus.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kyle. That was an awesome presentation. Can you tell us what your ask is of this particular audience?
Right now, I think outside of specifically here, we're certainly constrained. I don't want to make sure we go down any pitch categories. I would say the most important thing right now is an awareness. Understand that, as John said, we're going to knock on all your doors. I look around, I see a lot of faces of people I have already met and a lot of doors I've already knocked on. And so there's a lot in business. Every day that I learn something new, I learn two things that I don't know. And so I continue to look for advisory panel members, people that have expertise in this medical space, always looking to add people to my scientific advisory board, people that really have something concrete to add, that believe in this mission, that want to see people with diabetes have a new opportunity to safely inject this medication. So I always collecting more people that are smarter than me. And so anyone that has that availability, please go to the Purdue. I don't have a whole stack of business cards, but you go to the founder, you'll be able to find me. Drop me an email. I'm always welcoming bright minds. So please, please. I apologize. I see other hands. I am out of time, and I do apologize. So thank you very much.
Well done. Thank you, Kyle. Before I introduce our next company, I do want to just tell one quick story about Raul. One of the things we did when we created Purdue Ventures, exists, again, to run the funds that we're working on, but it also strategically manages our existing portfolio of startup investments that have occurred probably over the last dozen years or so. One of the things we did when we first formed Purdue Ventures was we got a group together from the university, from the Purdue Research Foundation, and did an inventory of what those holdings were. They tended to reside in accounting for audit purposes, but we weren't really managing them strategically. So we thought we had done a really pretty good job on the inventory. And then about a week later, I'm driving, I get a call from Raul, and he says, we're looking at some things relative to our next steps. Are there some folks in the VC community that you think would be particularly pertinent for us to talk to? And so we have that conversation, and then Raul says, and besides, you have a 17% stake in us. Thank you. We added it to the inventory. We knew it was there, but it was hard to find, as you well know. Anyways, next speaker from Prosolia, Raul Zavaleta.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Okay. Just press this button. Okay, you're going to have to guide me. Prosolia is in the business of helping doctors save patient lives. A few years ago, I went to a dinner party and met this man who told me he just had, 2 weeks prior, brain surgery. I looked at him, and it didn't look like he had brain surgery. Then he took his hat and showed me his scar. I said, wow. Are you okay? He said, yes, I'm fine. He said, and I'm particularly happy because I just received my post-surgery pathology report and it was negative, so I don't have to go back for any more surgery. A woman was overhearing us and joined the conversation. She said, my mother just had breast cancer surgery and her pathology report was positive and she had to go back for more surgery. As it turns out, during cancer surgery, surgeons determine how much cancer is in there or how much to take off by looking at the margins of the tumor in the microscope. Then they take a slice of that and send it to a laboratory where a week later, it takes a week to get that result, they tell you whether you got it all out. Would you believe this happens 20% of the time? That they have to go back for surgery. Well, next slide. There's a group at Brigham and Women's Hospital that think that this is not good enough. So they partnered with us and decided and use our DESI technology to determine at the operating room what those tumor margins are using our DESI instrument. Within minutes, and without any sample preparation whatsoever, they get the answer. Dr. Igar, who's leading this effort, said that she hopes to eliminate those repeat surgeries. So Dr. Livy Eberling at UT Health thinks we have revolutionized the way tissue diagnostics is done by collecting additional molecular information here that she believes that this is the way it's going to be done, not only at operating rooms, but in histopathology laboratories everywhere. Prosolia is in the business of helping doctors save patient lives. A few weeks ago, a team of doctors visited us from Cincinnati Children's Hospital. They wanted to share with us the significance our instrument has in their hospital. One of the physicians in the team shared the story of this young boy who underwent a stem cell transplantation, which is treated, then they put into a treatment with melphalan. It's an oncolytic drug. And he said, it is very hard for children to manage the optimum dosing range of melphalan in children. That little boy, unfortunately, did not survive. A few months later, his younger brother had the same thing, stem cell transplantation with melphalan. This time, however, they have our Velox system that allowed them to test the dosing range of melphalan right there when they were treating him. Within minutes, they knew the answer. This young boy is survived, is alive and well. And he wanted to know, the doctor's team wanted to tell us what a significant difference we were making at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. So see, Prosolia is in the business of helping doctors save patient lives. This Velox technology is also being launched to combat the epidemic of prescription drugs and heroin abuse. Many treatment centers around the country are looking for an instrument that allows them to test the patients right there in a simple way without any complicated sample prep and with results that can come out in minutes and without having a PhD interpreting them. Velox fits the bill. Now, Prosolia is not a new idea. It's not an idea. It's a technology that was invented at Purdue. We licensed it. We've gone through the pain of getting it in the market and acceptance in the market. We had 39% growth in revenue last year. We're going to have the same this year. That's why centers like Johns Hopkins University, University of Florida, Stanford Medical School, Harvard Medical School, UT Health, and others have joined us on doing research on some critical applications using our technology. And that's also why two large corporations, Thermo Fisher and Waters, have signed up as value-added resellers. We're in discussions with Agilent and AB SciX as well. We've sold this worldwide. About 40% of our sales comes from overseas. Our CEO, Justin Weissman, is in Southeast Asia right now, signing a deal with a distributor there because they think that Velox is going to be a big seller there. So with their help of these collaborators and these value-added resellers, we think that we can increase the number of doctors that we can help save patient lives. Now I'll take your questions. Yes.
So you're selling it now, right?
The
company has revenue now?
The company has revenue now, and it's been on the block for a while. So we're growing.
Yeah.
Continue to grow, yes.
And so what do you need help with?
Well, I wasn't supposed to ask for funding, but that's what we need help with. Because we really are in such a fast growth phase. It cannot be organically grown.
Yeah. How are you organized commercially? I mean, part of that, besides money, how have you decided to go about your commercialization strategy?
Good question. I briefly mentioned it. Because both the Velox and the DESI instruments are attachment to a mass spectrometer. We have two choices. We either OEM a mass spectrometer, which will require a lot more money and a lot more time, or we partner with the mass spectrometer companies. So we got Thermo, we got Waters, Agilent, AVSyX coming on. We've talked with Bruker. We have fittings for all of them, and we engage them to help us do this. So they do the marketing and sales, and that's the value-added reseller. That's how we do it. Okay, we do have our own sales team, small, because for existing devices, we can just simply attach it, and we sell those ourselves. Yeah. One question back there?
Yes.
Yes, there are other technologies. The team at Harvard, Brigham and Women's Hospital, they go into clinical trials for both brain and breast cancer surgery. There's a picture there, and this picture right here. You see there? That's that team, and that team. They get the answer right on the spot. This is the technology. We're not being FDA certified for this. It's a value-added reseller, a lab-developed test, so to speak. They are the ones who are getting the clinical trials and getting approved and all that. There are other things that
you're looking at.
One of them comes from the probe. The other one comes from our instrument. And so what it tells them is really where the margins are, so that they know that they removed everything. But it's a combination of things. And yes, it can be used for a lot of other things. And that's what they're trying to do with the clinical trial.
Thank you, Raul. Great example of moving technologies into the marketplace for the benefit of society, which is a great segue to our next speaker. It's a real pleasure to be able to introduce David Broeker, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Bioscience Research Institute. He's going to be presenting Apex Therapeutics from Indiana University.
Thanks, David. John. Thank you. I'm also the interim CEO of Apex Therapeutics, and that's what I'm here to talk about. Very excited. Thank you, Jenny Feinfield, for introducing me and volunteering me for this event. Apex Therapeutics is actually a discovery research that comes out of IU School of Medicine. The scientific founder of the company is an expert. His name is Dr. Mark Kelly. I've listened to Mark talk about, we talked about the duration and the amount of time it takes to sort of advance science. I heard Mark last week say that he's probably been working in this area of biology for about 25 years. Last year, three Nobel Prizes were awarded in his area of expertise. But as most people have started the presentations, it starts with a problem or a question. And so for Mark, the question was, why do cancer cells survive despite all of our best efforts to try to kill them with chemotherapeutic agents and other things? And so that led Mark on this journey of trying to understand, what is it about cancer cells? How do they adapt? How do they survive? And he was drawn to a particular area of biology involved in DNA repair. As you can imagine, when chemotherapeutic agents hit a cancer cell, it disrupts it, but it's the ability of that cancer cell to repair itself that basically enables it to survive. And so Mark was drawn to a particular protein called APE, APE1. It's apurinic, apyrimidinic endonuclease, so spelling test after this for that. But what Mark discovered was not only was this protein important from a DNA repair standpoint, but it was also very, very important from the standpoint of it had a second function. And this was his insight, and this was his discovery. And what he realized was this protein affected multiple transcription factors related to cancer cell survival, whether that was dealing with inflammation, whether that was dealing with angiogenesis, whether that was dealing with other immune response by the body. So Mark started this search for, I'm interested in some very specific transcription factors in this area of cancer. And he was drawn to a molecule, and it was a molecule that was formerly developed by a company in Japan called Eisai Pharmaceuticals. And the molecule's number was 3330. And so Mark started off with this understanding that Eisai had done something with this molecule. They thought it worked in a particular area. They were actually studying it for hepatitis. But Mark was drawn to its impact on one of these transcription factors. And when Mark got it into his model and basically saw that it worked, he was able to really define this second function to the A protein. That led to the formation of the company back in 2008, 2009. And ever since that time, we've been on a journey to try to, number one, try to discover new molecules. But when I came along back in 2013, 2014, I kept struggling with this question of why did we ever move away from 3330? Because this was essentially how you defined your science. This is what your patents were written on. What do we know about 3330? And the truth is we knew what Mark knew, but we knew very little about how it had been developed by Eisai Pharmaceuticals. So what we were able to do very quickly, and time is of the essence in drug discovery and drug development, we called up Eisai Pharmaceuticals and we said, can you tell us about 3330? Can you tell us why you decided to stop this program? And we're a small biotech company in Indianapolis, Indiana. Could we work with you to try to get all the information you have about 3330? And the business development person, her name's Yuki Takan at Eisai Pharmaceuticals, said, sure. Signed this confidentiality agreement, we'll send an investigator's brochure, and sure enough, we realized, holy cow, Eisai had taken this through not only the preclinical and the phase one, but they'd taken it through phase two development in over 400 patients. And they basically put it on the shelf when they in-licensed a drug called Humira with Abbott and ended up commercially, they put their resources behind helping Abbott commercialize Humira in the Japanese market. So we did a very, very quick deal with Eisai Pharmaceuticals, and we started getting boxes of information. At first, we didn't know whether they were all in Japanese, so we didn't know if they were sushi menus or not, but turned out there was a treasure trove of information. And then the challenge became, well, how do we get the team of people that are going to help us translate all these documents and go to the FDA and present it in such a way that the FDA would accept this, because all this work had been done in Japan. So we hired a great team of people, a lot of former Lilly people involved, and we went through a very careful translation process to get this thing put into an IND, investigational new drug application, which we were able to file in March, April of this year. And in June, the FDA gave us the thumbs up that we could proceed to our first phase one study, studying APEX 3330 in cancer. So our focus is, as people know, cancer's, one of the top killers in America and in the world, next to cardiovascular disease. Our focus is really on pancreatic cancer. When you look at pancreatic cancer, there's only three agents approved for pancreatic cancer. It's still one of the worst cancers in terms of survival, both one-year survival and five-year survival. And we really do think that we have a chance here, because what makes pancreatic cancer tough to treat relates back to these multiple transcription factors. They've found a way to survive despite all the best attempts to try to kill these cells. So we're in the process of getting ready to start our phase one study, and we hope to start that by the end of the year. With that, I'll take questions. back here.
Hi, I enjoyed your presentation. Have you studied the processing for cancer of carbohydrates and sugar and the body's metabolism of those when it relates to cancer?
We know that there's probably some metabolic effects associated with this science. We actually, because it involves the pancreas, we have actually a researcher at IU in the diabetes area who's collaborated with Mark to begin to look at a little bit of that, but we haven't studied that specifically as it relates to some of the cancer that we've done. Question? This is a small molecule. This was, again, discovered by Eisai Pharmaceutical. They thought it only worked in one of these transcription factors related to angiogenesis. Actually, it was a TNF-alpha inhibitor, which is what Humira is. So that's why they, you know, that's how they characterized it and how they thought about it. But Mark showed that it was much more multipurpose, multifunctional than just that.
One last question. Is it orally available?
Yes. Jenny?
Do you have any plans to work on new formulations? Since cancer patients sometimes struggle with eating and keeping things down, do you have any plans to maybe make it injectable and use the lovely device that was presented earlier this morning?
Great question. With the limited resources that we've had to date, we haven't done a lot of additional development, but we have on our sort of portfolio a whole set of ideas. I mentioned that there's been a lot of early work done on identifying new chemical analogs. So this particular molecule has a unique structure, and we've got several medicinal chemists trying to tweak that molecule, and Mark obviously has the ability to screen that in his lab. So we've been developing a library of different chemical compounds, so that's one thing. You know, most cancers, you attack the biology. You don't necessarily attack the tumor type, but the FDA makes you sort of hone in on a particular patient type. So while we, you know, are focused on pancreatic cancer because that's where we have our best preclinical data, we know that there are other cancers that this could probably work in. So we've screened in terms of where the overexpression of this particular protein is in numerous other cancers, so ovarian, prostate in particular would be two other things. We also think that this has protective effects with neurons. And there's a whole field that's starting to emerge regarding, somebody mentioned the neuropathy associated with diabetes, but many times chemotherapeutic drugs create neuropathy in cancer patients. And there's really nothing that you can do. You know, they try Neurontin and other things, but we think that Apex 3330 and the other chemical compounds might have protective effects there. So there's a whole host of things which, if we could give Mark a big R budget, he would pursue these. But right now, it's on the D side of starting the phase one study. Hey, Diane. Yeah, I think, you know, obviously with pre-existing drugs, there's a, if it's a, you know, it's been studied and evaluated, you have the history of that, and you can use that for specific, you know, development purposes, which is what we were benefited from by using Eisai's program. You know, the challenge with all this is the protection you get around it. You know, do you have IP around it? If you put in the effort and the time and the expense to try to develop it, you know, you investors and the companies want to be able to earn a return on that. So that's kind of the pro and the con of trying to repurpose this. But if you can accelerate it to market like we were able to. So, okay, I'm getting the red light and the hook from John.
Thanks,
Dave. Thank you.
So the importance of using the microphone for the questions is that this is going to be a BioCrossroads podcast. So what I'll do is I'll grab one of the microphones, handle this side of the room. Joe Beth will be over here on this side. So when you do have a question coming up, just please make sure you have the microphone. So earlier I talked about Animated Dynamics as a quintessential foundry client, but you know what? There's multiple quintessential foundry clients, and Echinocure is one of them. speaking of this overall system and all the different moving parts with entrepreneurship at Purdue, interestingly, I first met Shireen when she was going through the Entrepreneurship Leadership Academy as a faculty member with, at that point, an idea. So that has really now developed into a company, into commercialization activity. I'd like to introduce Shireen Abdulmawla.
So good morning, everyone. As John said, thank you. And my name is Shireen Abdulmawla, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of AkenoCure Pharmaceuticals. AkenoCure is a drug development company, and our story started 2 years ago when we decided to take a look at the current status of cancer therapy for solid tumors. And when we looked at the picture, it looked something like that. There was a very promising technology called immunotherapy, where you're activating the immune system to fight the to fight the cancer and kill it. But when we looked at it, you'll see that it works really well for blood cancers, and it works well for solid tumors when it works. But unfortunately, it doesn't work for everybody with solid tumors. Only a small percentage of patients respond, let alone the fact that you're unleashing the immune system on your cancer, but your own body gets caught in the crossfire. And sometimes the side effects are so severe that you have to stop the treatment, and it's too expensive to develop. So the backbone of treating solid tumors is still chemotherapy. But you're looking at chemotherapy that was invented, drugs that were invented 20 years ago. They've already reached a plateau where you're not going to get any more effect out of them, more than they already have shown us. Patients usually relapse, and when they come back, they're resistant to that treatment. But the good thing about it is most patients respond to it at the beginning, and it's very inexpensive to develop compared to immunotherapy. So we looked at the picture and we said, wouldn't it be great if we find what we, if we call chemotherapy first generation small molecules, can we find those second generation small molecules, something that has the best of both worlds, something that is not expensive to develop, that works for most patients with solid tumors, but has the same effect or this powerful effect that immunotherapy has, something that has no side effects, something that prevents relapse, something that doesn't just stop the cancer from growing, but it also stops it from spreading and metastasizing. So it was a huge undertaking, and at that time, we thought we should make this our mission. We're going to make this our mission to find those molecules, make them, design them, and introduce them as breakthrough therapeutics for unmet needs in cancer. But when you think about something like this, where do you usually start? So at that time, the skill set of the founders are mostly chemistry. So we wanted to look for something we can make. So at that time, one of the highly reputed journals in our field, Nature Medicine, highlighted the fact that marine animals, marine creatures, they produce very powerful cancer drugs. And they actually called it a treasure trove of cancer drugs. So we thought, okay, can we find a molecule that has all those characteristics of that second generation molecules we're looking for? And indeed, we actually found AK-321. AK-321, not only does it have every characteristic I just described, it's truly almost like a miracle molecule. And it is effective against a number of cancers, but we've decided to go for ovarian cancer as a first indication. It's a huge unmet need. It's a death sentence for a lot of women when they get it, but it's also a death trap for drug development. A lot of people have tried and failed. So why do we think we will make it with ovarian cancer? So what we did is, if you know anything about ovarian cancer, usually patients respond, but 80% of them, over 80% actually come back with a relapse. When they come back, those women are usually resistant to those treatments. So our collaborators, we have a collaboration with the National Cancer Institute. So they took cancer cell lines, ovarian cancer cell lines, that are resistant to treatment. And then they looked at AK-321 versus Taxol. Taxol is the chemo drug approved for ovarian cancer currently. And AK-321 was about 8,000 times more potent. The fact that it works in resistant cells itself is amazing. The fact that it's 8,000 times better is beyond exciting. I have never seen that number in any drug currently in development or currently used, not even for immunotherapy. I haven't seen that number. So we're very excited and holding our breath how this molecule will perform when we move it to animal models. But there is one thing that is very peculiar about AK-321, peculiar about this class of molecules in general that come from marine animals. They tend to be extremely complex in structure. So AK-321 was known for about 30 years. Everybody knows how powerful it is. And some major labs in chemistry have tried to make it, and for 30 years they have failed. It's a hugely complex molecule. So because we have a platform that was invented at Purdue and we licensed from Purdue, a chiral carbon catalog, so that platform allows us to actually make those really complex molecules. And that's the advantage that we have. We're not even scared that somebody can take the IP from us. We talk about it openly because nobody can make it. And even our competitors would rather work with us than compete against us because we have something they don't. And a year and a half ago, we started tackling this molecule. And about a month ago, we were about to throw the towel because it's a huge undertaking and it's very complex. Every step was a big deal. And we just had a breakthrough. We finally finished the last challenge with this molecule last week. So right now, production mode, we're just going to make it, send it to the NCI for testing. It's over 85 steps of conversion synthesis, with every step being a pain beyond description. So we're like in a very good place now. So I'm happy I'm giving this presentation after that breakthrough last week, because otherwise I'd be depressed. But I really don't like to put numbers on cancer because it's not about the numbers and it's not about the profit. It's about making a difference in people's lives. But I just put this just so there's a need and there's a market. And hopefully for our investors, there'll be a return. As far as milestones, we secured our IP. We licensed from Purdue. We have our own. We're hoping to have some results, animal results, like prelim animal results, the end of this year. Spend next year on an IND, and 2018, somewhere middle 2018, hopefully we can be in phase one if everything goes well. Our team is myself, Noshi, and Dr. Fuchs. As I said, we're mainly chemists, and our skill set is chemistry and actually cancer therapeutics, and we've done that in academia and industry. Our advisory board more than complements our skills, so we have Dr. Homer, who's the expert in drug development. We have Dr. Ritter, who's the expert in drug production. And we have Dr. Harb, who is mainly doing clinical studies on multiple cancers, ovarian being one of them. So we think we have the team to push this forward. And with that, I'm going to say thank you for giving us the chance to share our story with you, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Questions?
Shireen, you are awesome. That is so exciting what we just heard. Love the presentation. Thank you for doing what you're doing. Can you tell us what we as an audience can do to support you in your research efforts, please?
Yeah, so the reason I was happy to come to this event is that, as you know, it gets to be lonely, and it gets to be lots of ups and downs when it comes to drug development. And just knowing the community, knowing the ecosystem I work with, it's a huge support system for us. The amount of advice we've got from everybody, the amount of mentorship we've got from everybody, the connections that everybody was excited to make for us is a big deal. So I'm always excited to be here and to get to know everybody, because without that we wouldn't make it.
Hey Shireen, can you in the back? Very well done. Can you just elaborate on some of the other companies that are also chasing AK-321 and what they've done to position their drugs with AK-321? I'm thinking specifically of Novartis and the work that they've done.
Okay, so when it comes to complex molecules like that, usually big pharma don't get excited unless there's a published synthesis for it. So once somebody can make it, then they get excited about it. So we don't have a competition. We don't know of anybody going after AK-321, but Novartis has patented a combination AK-321 with actually DNA damaging agents, and there's a huge synergistic effect for that, and that's exciting because that's the beloved combination for ovarian cancer. So we're excited to take that, combine it with DNA damaging agents, and see what happens, and hopefully they will cooperate.
One over here.
I'm just kind of curious what kind of sea creature you guys found this molecule in. I'm wondering what sea creature this was found in.
It comes out of a sea slug. Yeah, not a pretty thing, but it's actually a delicacy in Japan, so they eat it. They don't die from it. They eat it.
Great. Thank you, Shireen. And I know you do have to get going. So don't feel bad about walking out, because I know you got to get to a meeting. So if I say quintessential three times, is that diluted? Four. Holy smokes. So we got a lot of quintessential client companies. I'd like to introduce Matthew Ward from Drug Free Therapeutics.
Thank you very much for having me here today. I'm the founder and chief science officer of Drug Free Therapeutics. We're a precision medicine company that focuses on upgrading dated neurostimulators that stimulate the nervous system to treat disease into smart, modern stimulators that can automatically regulate therapy. Chronic pain was the reason we got into this. Neurostimulation can be applied to 40 to 50 applications that we know of right now, but in chronic pain, it has the most need. There are really only two viable treatment options in chronic pain, and those include drugs, and then when all drugs fail, there's neurostimulators. In America alone, 100 million people suffer from chronic pain. And now this is pain that is present even though there's not an identifiable physiological cause. This can cause a $635 billion economic burden. Now, the kind of artistic rendering of that man there is meant to help me explain what pain is and where it comes from. Pain and chronic pain, as I said, it comes from, well, no identifiable cause. So if you have an injury, there is an identifiable cause. So you expect pain, and that's actually good for you because you don't want to re-injure that part. When that keeps going, what happens is that pain message is really transmitted to your brain so you can perceive it through nerves. So those nerves, for whatever reason, are just sending pain signals to your brain even though the injury is healed and there's nothing identifiable about it. What neurostimulators can do is they can go in there and they can intercept that message or block that message and replace it with something different. Fortunately, right now, they replace it with something that's more of like a uncomfortable pins and needles sensation. It's better than a chronic pain for a lot of people, but even to get that sensation, it can take up to 2 years. Now, opioids are a big problem. They're effective in the short term, but in the long term, they create huge, huge problems. They're highly addictive. 8 out of 10 heroin users out there started as a result of their first opioid prescription. There is, out of the $40 billion market for pain therapeutics, unfortunately, opioids, or well, predominantly opioids, make up about 90% of the market. The other 10% is neurostimulators and predominantly spinal cord stimulation. Now, spinal cord stimulation has a lot of promise, but it's been applied incorrectly. The hope was that you could just place these devices called electrodes against the nervous system and just crank up the current, and then you would get more pain relief with more current. But in reality, you get more pain from more current in a lot of cases, and in some cases, you miss the targets altogether. We want to stimulate very specific neural pathways that transmit those pain sensations. In comes the use of feedback. So we can measure signals from those pathways, and we've been able to do that for 100 years, but we haven't been able to link that to how to change the stimulus together. Now, there's a big, big interest right now in something called bioelectronic medicine, and that's precisely what we're doing here. So the thought is to lock into specific neural pathways and to use these neural pathways and the molecules that are transmitted to the tissues that these nerves are connected to treat disease, so that you use your body's own drugs to treat disease. For chronic pain, we are right at the point where we can do this. For many other diseases, we're getting there slowly. This is a slide taken from DARPA. It's one of the funding sources at Purdue University that we have. They're looking at it in a, very what they call closed-loop manner. So if you think about a thermostat regulating your temperature, they want devices to function the same way. The problem is that every individual is different, so you need to know, that device needs to know how to communicate a therapeutic message to that specific patient at any point in time they're feeling pain. This leads us to our innovation, which is a medical device software upgrade to existing neurostimulators that allows the doctor to directly select which pathway they want to block or augment, and allows the patient to describe their very subjective symptoms to the stimulator through a mobile application, so that this combination of information converges into a therapy that automatically personalizes to the patient's needs and comfort. This equates to reduced battery usage, it equates to better therapy, and it equates to a time to efficacy that can be upwards of 2 years to less than 5 minutes. Now, this has been a very challenging market. The Foundry has been a blessing since it started, and that they've really helped us navigate this area. One of our biggest challenges has been how to convince our customers, which are people who already have medical devices on the market, that their devices are kind of dumb, if for lack of a better term. They've been basically shocking and seeing what happens for years now, and that's not a very effective way to do things, especially when the patient is already uncomfortable and in pain in the first place. So what they've done is help us to structure a model where we can actually give them benefits and through a licensing and supply agreement where we take a percent of their devices enhanced with our product, and they benefit from a device that doesn't have to go through the full regulatory system approval process again. They can take their same device, augment it, do a small study, and resubmit that to the FDA for and a much reduced cost. Our customers now have been mid-stage companies, and they swear by this technology because they see it as a competitive edge in pain. So while spinal cord stimulation is useful, they're looking at external stimulators, and that's really where we've seen the bulk of our customer interest at right now, something that is as simple and effective as a pill and does not have the side effects that pills or conventional neurostimulators do. We have a John Ward sitting there in the back. He's a physician entrepreneur, has 40 years of experience, as well as a doctor and a healthcare executive. There's Pedro Irathoki. He's a tenure professor at Purdue University, a very great guy. And David Duram, who's been helping us out with new business development. And then finally, just like that, we've got a great advisory team, thanks to Purdue SV Big, and the continued mentorship of the Foundry. Thank you.
Questions.
What is your revenue model here?
Well, we're pre-revenue at the moment. We're in developing devices at the moment, but we're looking at the agreements we've signed, looking to get between 4 and 6% of the final device cost of the customers. So, and I'm the chief science officer, I should have mentioned as well, so I can also divert to John for a more intelligent answer.
Are your devices wireless, or are they linked by implantable?
It is functional in a fully implantable, fully wireless system, but we're looking to kind of skip the whole regulatory pathway and put that burden on customers. And by having devices available out there that are wireless, yes, we can get that wireless functionality. And most of the newer mid-stage companies already have that wireless functionality incorporated, as well as the sensors that we need. They just don't know how to close the loop, if you will.
Great presentation. So your model seems to be embedded software in existing devices. Is that correct?
Correct.
You thought about going all the way and doing your own freestanding device eventually?
We have explored that, yes. We want to get some. So we have a device that we can actually do that with potentially already, and we have identified platforms where that are a bit more agnostic as to what indication it's applied to. But we just don't see that as a great focus right now because we have medical device software, we have specific expertise that nobody else has right now, and we have the ability to get to market much quicker by leveraging other people's devices. Because our ultimate goal, is to get a viable treatment that can be used alongside opioids or instead of opioids as the first-line treatment. And we want to do that as quickly as possible to help solve the crisis that we're facing here in Indiana and in the nation.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
Next up, straight from Bloomington, is Wild Pitch East, Matthew Bachman.
All right, so we're really going to switch gears now. I don't do drug screening. I don't make medical devices. I'm trying to sell yeast. So I'm co-founder of Wild Pitch Yeast. There we go. But I'm also an assistant professor at IU. So I'm an educator first, and sort of why I'm here is to try to educate you as to why you might care in somebody that wants to sell yeast. So our major target right now are craft brewers and home brewers. And in 2015, the newest numbers we have, there was a $1.2 billion of economic impact from craft brewing in Indiana, $220 billion in the U.S. There's 120, 130 craft breweries in state. There's 4,600 across the U.S. There's a million-plus homebrewers out there. So we're trying to get a piece of that pie. All right, so I'm a lab geek. I've been working on yeast as a model organism for 15 years to answer scientific questions. That's our guy there, Saccharomyces cerevisiae. I work on basic biology in the lab. We do some cancer-related things. There's a bit of data here, yeast strains that we've plated out on plates that contain chemotherapeutics, and different mutations of these strains sensitize the cells to the chemotherapeutics and make them resistant to it. Now, the same yeast that we use in the lab to do all these things, it's baker's yeast and it's brewer's yeast. So I've always had sort of an interest in other things to do with the yeast. I was a home brewer myself. I've made wine, hard cider, things like that. Beer, when you boil it down, is really, really simple. It's made of four different things: water, barley, hops, and yeast. And craft brewers and home brewers play with all these things. They're citizen scientists. They experiment with all of these, but really they don't experiment a lot with the yeast. There's two species they use, several strains, but two species, and that's sort of it. And it's a disservice to them as experimenters and us as beer consumers, because yeast can create over 50% of the finished flavor and the aroma profile of a beer as long as it's not heavily hopped. So the yeast is really bringing a lot to the table. So there's this local movement that's been going on, farmers markets, things like that. For brewers, it's brew local, drink local. Go down to your local brew pub, your local craft brewery. But nobody in America makes a truly local beer, because they're all using European origin strains. So that's what we bring to the table, is we can go to any site anywhere in the world and find beer-worthy yeast there. We can go yeast hunting and find a local strain, and so there are breweries in Indiana now that are using Indiana hops, barley that's grown and malted in-state, and Indiana yeast. And not just, oh, it came from Bloomington, it came from Indianapolis. We can go ultra-local. We can get it out of the brew house. We can get it out of the brewer's backyard. And basically, people can submit samples to us: soil samples, tree bark, bugs, flowers, beard hair, whatever it might be. It's happened. And I hope it was beard hair. We've worked out a process where we can take these samples and enrich for the yeast that are going to make beer, and end up with pure cultures that we can send back to those guys. They can pitch it into a batch of beer and sell it to all of us. So just a little proof of principle of how we go from sort of the lab to the pub here. This is a project we did with the Broad Ripple Brew Pub. It's like 15 or 20 minutes away from where we are right now. Let me go back, actually. So they had small time frame, 6 weeks, few hundred dollars. They wanted to go yeast hunting. They wanted to make a bicentennial ale. A bicentennial ale, it's a beer made with as many Indiana-specific ingredients as you can get. So they sent us 20 different samples: pine cones, soil, cobwebs from their brew house, all these different things. They sent it to us. We ran it through our mill in the lab, and we isolated 17 different strains. So 12 of the 20 samples were positive for yeast. Some of them had more than one yeast. We got 17. We did 17 test fermentations, and then basically went and drank beer with the brewer and say, okay, do you like this one? Do you like that one? And seven of them performed really well. Four of them had really, really good flavor profiles. The other three weren't bad. They were just more neutral. You can do neutral. They wanted something that was spicy or fruity. And this is what we did. We isolated a yeast strain from the cobwebs in the brew house, and they call their beer cobwebs. Right? It's a sort of a Belgian style, spicy, fruity kind of thing, like I was talking about, and it's been a big seller for them. So I'm housed in Simon Hall. Wild Pitch Yeast sort of exists on paper, and IU is nice enough to let me squat in my own academic lab and do this kind of stuff. And we're hoping to branch out now. We're doing projects with lots of breweries in state and actually across the U.S. now. So I'm happy to take questions on that.
I have one. And this is probably more of a process question relative to brewing, but how big a problem is it when you cross-contaminate types of yeast? Or maybe the corollary to that question is, what are you doing to make your strains pure?
So, coming from a lab perspective, I know sterile technique, and I know pure culture techniques and things like that, which the brewers don't necessarily know. So everything we have, we start with a soil sample, and we get it out down to the single species level on basically Petri dishes, and I can sell you a pure culture of this, a pure culture of that. It is tough in an industrial brew house setting, though, because people use just multiple strains all the time. You've got your English ale yeast, you've got your Belgian strain, this, that, and the other thing. So even within in there trying to keep cross-contamination down, they do a lot of cleaning, basically.
It seems this is very custom service. Is this a scalable process?
It is scalable. So what we offer is the custom yeast hunting. So you can send us samples, and we'll run through it. But we also just have a bank of yeast strains that we've got from Indiana, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, wherever it is. So if you're a Michigan brewer and you want a Michigan strain, we might have something that works for you, or we can look for it. But growing yeast is super simple. It's like growing E. coli or any other microbe in a lab. So, you know, what we can do in a shaking incubator and cost us $12, we can sell to a brewery for $600, and that's a deal to them. So it's almost, you know, pure profit. It's highly scalable, yeah.
Nice margin.
How about it?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, you sell to them for $600, but I mean, what's the cost of yours versus maybe just them, you know, getting the typical European strain?
So that's a good question. So there are two big yeast labs that basically supply everybody right now, and they're both on the West Coast. So that's a 30-barrel pitch. So to make 30 barrels worth of beer, they charge $600 as well, but it costs $700 in shipping. So I can go to a brewery in Bloomington and say, okay, I'll charge you the same amount, but I'll just walk the yeast to your brewery and share a pint of beer with you, and you're going to save $700 by me charging the same amount. So locally, we've got a big advantage that way. As soon as we start shipping further afield, we're going to run into the same problem.
But you're priced competitive.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't want to be the bargain basement guys just because we could.
Thank you, Matt.
All right.
And now batting cleanup is Vibronics, and I'd like to introduce Ree Lee and Yan Jia. Client companies.
Well, let's switch back to Purdue. And hey, everyone. We are Burnix. My name is Ree Lee. I'm the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs.
And hello, everyone. I'm Yan Xia. I'm responsible for software development right now.
First, I would like to thank Purdue Foundry. They give us tremendous help consistently and patiently. Well, let's start with a scenario. Melissa was recovering at home from lumpectomy surgery the week ago, and a phone call from a doctor told her they didn't get all the cancer and she was going to need another surgery. She was angry and afraid of potential complications and time away from her family. This was known as reoperation, and unfortunately, this is going to happen to 42,000 women in the United States this year.
In lumpectomy surgery, the doctor cast the cancer out of the patient's breast, and they were trying to leave a 2 millimeter or greater margin of healthy tissue surrounding the cancer. So this ensures that no cancer was left behind. But To assess the margin, the doctor sends the tissue to a lab, but unfortunately, this takes 3 to 5 days to get results. So if they finally find not enough tissue was removed, the patient will have to return for another operation. This problem is so common that 1 in 4 lapectomies fails. So this leads to 42,000 reoperations per year. At $7,000 per surgery, this costs the United States over $300 million a year. So that's why our company invented a margin pad, a medical imaging device that can quickly and accurately assess the patient's tissues during a surgery in just 10 minutes and help the doctors get all the cancer the first time. Our working prototype is being used at IU Health, and based on our results, we can reduce reoperation from 25% to just 2%. Our device will benefit all stakeholders in the healthcare system. Hospitals will increase their efficiency, insurance companies will reduce their costs, and the patients will avoid pain and stress. We've been endorsed by several leading breast cancer surgeons, and our business model has been validated through conversations with 2 former directors of Medicare.
While Bronix will make money by selling margin pad to hospitals for $90,000 at a 44% gross margin, for each surgery, they'll need to buy a cartridge from us for $300 at a 90% gross margin. Because the average facility performs 100 lumpectomies per year, and because our margins are so high, this represents a sustainable and profitable business. We have also partnered with Bank of America to offer leasing options for our customers. So we are very confident that FDA will approve our device because margin pad is low risk and is eligible for 6 months approval. We will enter the market in 3 phases. So in phase 1, we will expand our clinical trial and file our FDA application. In phase 2, we will begin manufacturing. And in phase 3, we will enter US market. Margin pad achieves higher speed and accuracy than any intraoperative methods on the market. Our device is 20% more accurate than the next best product. We have filed 4 patents and exclusively licensed from Purdue University. Because of margin pad's superior performance and our patents, we will have rapid sales growth, and we will take market shares from our competitors. Based on our conservative estimate of 167 units sold in the first 3 years, in 2020, we will have $14.4 million in revenues. Our team is comprised of medical imaging specialists and industry experts with experience in the areas of regulation, reimbursement, R&D, finance, and clinical designs. So in closing, while our business represents a valuable investment opportunity, the greatest value that we can provide is in improving the lives of women and their families. If 1 in 4 iPhones that Apple built was defective, people would be up in arms. So why would we accept this level of error in the treatment of women that we love most? We do not think this is acceptable, and we hope you will join us in a mission to improve patient care. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are happy to take any questions.
Could you describe the device in more detail, please?
Okay.
We are using a photoacoustic imaging to do a diagnosis of the tumor with the cut from the breast. So we use photoacoustic to the imaging of the fat. Then we will build a 3D model of the tissue cut. So we will show where is the positive margin and where is the negative margin. So if there is positive margin, I mean, there's less than 2 millimeter gray margin of healthy tissue. So that means you need to cut more. So that's how it works.
Yeah. And also I would like to add a little bit. The beauty of our technology is our device provides a 3D imaging of the whole excised tissue, and it can very accurately tell the surgeon where is a positive margin. So the surgeon can trace back to cut the only cancer tissue.
Yeah.
So what is it about photoacoustic imaging that can differentiate healthy tissue from diseased tissue? Is it density, or I mean, what's the feature, the functionality that you're able to differentiate?
Oh, this is a very scientific question. Photoacoustic imaging, it provides, I mean, as my colleague said, it provides the imaging of fat. So it's based on the chemical information. It's based on the spectroscopy. Yeah, this is a very short answer. If you would like to know more details, yeah, we can discuss later. Yeah.
Other questions? Thank you, guys. Just a couple of quick things in closing. First of all, thanks to all of you for being here. I really want to thank David Johnson and Lori and Joe Beth and everybody from BioCrossroads and the whole Frameworks program giving us the opportunity to do this. I thought this was a great venue for this. Also want to thank Guttwein Law. Tyler, I saw you someplace here. As well as Ice Miller, which are co-sponsoring this along with us. And then finally, you know, just a word on Foundry X. Foundry X stands for exchange. It's an exchange of ideas. It's an exchange of views, people, all to help us continue to build the network. I would like to particularly thank the Foundry X ambassadors. If you'd kind of by hand show who's here, there's four or five of them here, as well as both the Foundry and the OTC staff that joined us. There's a few of them here. So, and again, thanks to all of you. And I think we are now concluded.